we have worked with a fund to the
because the regulation of the environment will affect the climate, however, under NEMA. going to suggest that in fact we elevate the course of your public participation in 24.4b to 24.4a. So it's very clear that you have to have public participation. You think that is really going to address that? You make it a lot. So in other words, for EIA, there has to be. And then what is the question we have read about documents from the minister or the minister to make guidelines around how that public participation takes place? On the issue of exemption, our understanding again, and we consider this clarity, is that our understanding is that in the way that we wrote it, cannot be exempted from having to do environmental authorization. That what you can be exempted from under particular sets of circumstances is to be exempted from particular elements, procedures in the process. So, for example, I think the issue raised by Mr. Aron about ground storage tanks. If you're doing a big construction, you need an above ground storage tank on a construction site. There's nowhere else that it can be except from that construction site. And so in that set of circumstances, the issue of alternatives just becomes a sufficient thing because, you know, the purpose of the storage tank is for one development and you're not going to put it anywhere else. So why kind of try to make it sort of do a particular thing about where an alternative is, you know, that you might then want to say that we linked in from the need to look at alternatives because in fact there is no need for alternatives. So what we are suggesting then and when we come on to this we look at it as an amendment that makes clear that when we talk about exemptions, we're only talking about exemptions from procedures and the regulations and the ordinary expression rather than exemptions from the requirements in the law. I think that the second thing about exemptions that it's important to understand is that the system of commandments or the old system was largely based on exemptions. So if you look at, if you were to go and look at every single EIA that's been done across the country, you would find probably that what about 67% of them has been processed through the exemption application. In that exemption application, the way it works is that people say, I want to do it for them, then, and I want to be exempted from having to do it for the EIA. And the authorities that got exercised for 7 days in the area, say what you want to do, explain what the impacts are, and then if no one objects, we'll give you the extension. That is how the system actually works at the moment. Has worked in fact up until the 2006 regulations, but it's made it work in a water standard way. So I think that what we're trying to do is to ensure that in dealing with extensions, you apply your mind a bit more seriously and the way you deal with it is more systematic and more related to the appropriateness in relation to a particular kind of development rather than the way that it was done. I mean, we would see this in fact, meaning that you have a much more tight and tight systematic version of what you need to do and what you don't. And from what we're suggesting, a textual case that will make sure that it's not a key issue from either of the conventions or elements in the regulation. Then lastly, I think that the issue in the public hearing was in introducing these changes to NEPA, what we want to do is introduce a broader range of environmental management tools. Right from the beginning, it was always seen that EIA would be one of a range of tools, and in trying to get the system embedded and up and running and functioning, I think it would be very difficult. Government hasn't had up until recently the ability to do that. And we have done, there is a whole lot of groundwork that has been done, a whole lot of guidelines, documents that have been prepared of things like risk assessments and strategic environmental assessments that we now want to put into the law and to make them tools that can be used. More kind of tools that are more appropriate to a particular kind of development. And the example that comes to mind is sort of it. EIAs are very much a tool that relates to construction activity. Looking at what is the impact of a particular construction activity on a particular receiving environment? Are there detrimental impacts? Can you manage to mitigate those detrimental impacts? Or should the development not happen? Or if it happens, with what conditions? That's what the EIA does. And we're using it for everything. So, for example, the issue of biocontrol agents. see, there seems to be an issue about they've got plants, something like water hyacinth that is causing a problem to the environment. You need to deal with it. You've got a bug of some kind, and you know, if you put on that plant, you're going to keep it up and deal with the problem. And instead of using a risk assessment, you say, what is the risk of reducing that bug into the environment? Do we know that it's not going to destroy other species? Do we know that that bug is not going to multiply and destroy other indigenous bugs or whatever? We're using the EIA for that instead of using the risk assessment. Internationally, you use risk assessment for those kinds of GMO applications, biodiversity-linked applications, which issues the risk of spread. It's not the vast. You can't really authorize it in the same way. So we're using tools that don't fit at the moment. So in giving ourselves a broader set of tools, we think that we would be able to manage the environment better. Similarly, I think that in the hearing last week, people were saying we need a strategic environment to look at the impact of coal mining on them from an underpasso, because we're looking at a much broader set of issues in terms of prison standards than simply one development for one mine, what the CIA actually looks at. And you need to look into the future, you need to say what is this going to be 20 years into the future, you need to be able to look at the potential impact, you need to be able to consult about broader set of stakeholders from a much more multiple set of sectors than you would do in the CIA. So for something like that, when you've got this very large development, a very large impact, you won't be interested in the environmental assessment. And at the moment, you can do it on a voluntary basis, you don't have the legal ability to be able to make the conclusions of that process binding and to be able to determine how the development will or won't take place in relation to the outcome of that. So there, what we are suggesting, I think the one thing that we picked up is that we talk about that in a sense, a menu of tools, but what we haven't, I think, done clearly enough is to say that each one of those tools needs their own set of guidelines to say how and when and under what circumstances they are used. So we suggested an amendment that will make it clear that each of those tools is a set of guidelines that needs to then be put in place in order that those tools are used appropriately for those things of different circumstances, and that the system can work properly. So I think those were the main issues. Just on the issue, there's one more issue. Sorry, I'm going to actually ask you to make a question.
One of the issues I've seen marked from the chair relates to the province's ability or the institute's ability to make regulations and how NEMA manages that. The problem that we have here is in the constitution. The constitution may demand management and therefore regulations related to environmental management are concurrent functions between provinces and the national department. So we cannot through NEMA take the rights of provinces to make regulations away. But the general principle of law is that provinces can only make regulations within the framework of national legislation. So they can only make regulations that are more strict than the national legislation. So they can only supplement national regulations or make regulations that are more strict than national legislation.
I think that what that means is at the national level we would have to get those regulations out very fast. And I think we've done the work, we have done quite a lot of work on the guidelines around the segment. So we could get the national bottom lines out quite fast from there. So we don't end up with a fragmented and inconsistent framework of control. I think those are the key broad issues that we wanted to respond to. And as I said, we have got some textual proposals.
I'd like to invite the members to talk to this member.
from now on we will be able to detect their contextual opinion. Are there any comments on what is your case?
Thank you, sir. I just wanted to get clarity specifically on these new tools that you suggested, strategic environmental assessments, and the kind of binding nature of that. And let's take the example of the coal mines, for instance. What is this legislation saying in terms of how we would treat coal mine development in Mpumalanga using SEAs? Are we saying that an SEA would have to be done first on that area, and based on the outcomes of that SEA, we would then be able to stipulate what type of development should happen, where the coal mining should go ahead? I want to understand the kind of nuts and bolts of this as to what kind of binding effect these specific guidelines have.
Thank you, Jake. I'm going to be the whole drum that I've been meeting on for the last 2 weeks. And this is with regard, firstly, to the issue of competent authority, and secondly, with regard to the issues of exception. I understand that the department has a certain desire, but it's not being achieved. They say that they want NEMA reviews. They say that they would ideally like one system, which would presumably mean 10 competent authorities, the 9 provinces and DME, and not, sorry, the 9 provinces and DEET, and not the various DME branches as well. And they've said that on numerous occasions. Now, Chair, that's the wish list they have put on the table, and I remain concerned about the fact that this legislation regards is going to propose them as a competent authority, despite the fact that they have run their own environmental authorization up to now anyway. GRC, we have an interesting occurrence in Parliament at the moment with two pieces of legislation before Parliament, the NCRDA and the NEMA amendment bill. And I cannot see why the department has come from a point of view of, well, the two departments can't come together on this for whatever reason. And I know that there have been involvement by the deputy president on this issue. But I see no reason why, as portfolio committees, we should not be able to engage each other to support this issue further, because these have a particular desire. And why can't we, as the legislators on the portfolio committee of environmental affairs, because ultimately, at this stage of the process, the power lies with us, it does not lie with us. And to try and force an improved situation where all regulations, all competent authorities are nature and environment departments of this country. Not that I want to make a speech, but yesterday I received a very interesting reply from the Minister of Environmental Affairs and Tourism to a question I put to him on the issue of these mines, and it came at a very unique time. And I asked him whether he was aware of these applications and about the strategic environmental assessment. And to his credit, he said that he would like to issue an environmental management framework. All very good. But he also said that he was extremely concerned about what was happening in Mpumalanga, and had asked for all applications, both scoping and EIA reports, to be sent to the Department of Environmental Affairs and Tourism. So, one of that is an issue of concern. And two is that if he's asking for these anyway, why not just take over the process entirely? So that was an interesting thing that happened yesterday. So you know, Mr. Chair, you may want to proceed with the processing of this bill today. I, however, remain uncomfortable with that because I don't think we should rush this, and I'm interested to know why, from the point of view of the department, we should be rushing it. Secondly, and this is with regard, in my general view, to the so-called exemption. I mean, I understand that from the point of view of the DDG that there are certain noble intentions about it. And I don't dispute those intentions at all. But I have a fundamental problem with granting the right to the minister, whoever the minister may be, to grant these exemptions, because by doing so, and without having seen the sub-regulations that flow after, because by doing that, we hand over power, more power from our portfolio committee to the executive. And that I find very, very problematic. Because while I'm not suggesting that there's any malicious intent at all, there's always the potential. Law stands on the cards for a long time. So those are my two more narrow comments. My broader comment is that, Chair, I'm a bit more concerned that as a portfolio committee we haven't had yet enough substantial input, and granted we ran a public hearing process and it was advertised, but whether we as a committee ourselves have come to the conclusion and know ourselves all the problems relating to the current way environmental impact assessments are run in this country. With regards to the issue of, you know, the need to streamline and the so-called claim that the process is difficult and so on, I mean, I wonder whether we as members of Parliament all are as briefed as we could be on this particular challenge. And I remain concerned, Chair, that we are rushing through this legislation. I accept that there are many amendments today, which many of which may be good, but, you know, my honest request, sir, is that we, you know, continue to process, but, you know, do it at a pace where we can get more information and if need be, stand over for the until next year.
Just around another issue, also of extension, I'd just like a bit more clarity on, and while I understand that there will not be an extension from the actual EIS process, I just wonder when it's happening, it's a complex issue, because different Johnson standards would apply when to different apparent extensions, and what is the, how does it work as far as public interest is concerned? How do they get to know, you know, sometimes the law says something, but the reality on the ground becomes different, and people really don't, may not be sufficiently aware of something is going on which may not really be regarded as an extension, but it's not what they thought was going to happen. And the other one is, and I've raised this before, around the whole issue of minimum requirements. I know what the department is saying, that's virtually impossible. Because the EIA processes, they claim, have not worked in the past, that there's been that there's now going to be a whole range of options which are possible, because they apply to different situations, to different industries. But I still have a feeling that the minimum requirements, that the bottom line, should be an established one, should be an overriding one, that those should be there clear for all those different applications to consider. That they know that they cannot go further down the back bottom line, that is absolutely cast in concrete. Because otherwise you're going to find people always push the line. They always push for, our worlds are profit oriented, and you're going to find that different industries, different people, different developers will not really abide by what I think should be there, if it's not really made really clear and it's clear in the law.
Just a blame my mind what the police have done. I just wonder why we should come to an end to this about the security of the people. And considering the fact that we are desirous of. And then unfortunate about that. That's not our position. But it's good. One thing is, that's a good reason. What has not gone on to me? And then the president signs it, and then the recipient loans are just waiting now. In fact, the public guarantees was to introduce it to the public. I think we just don't need the petition. And then once the president is going to come up now, I don't know where it's going to be. Someday. And I can just list a number of some fun out there. Now, why do you start with my passport? You can see the not going to ask for your company. If incorporated in the academia will enhance the broad strength, then the other questions that are very, very confusing will leave for next year. So that we treat this deal as work in progress instead of subjecting it to too much judicial work. But it gives us an opportunity to look at the DND on the other side. So now they do not themselves now become the public enemy number one of ours.
Okay, I want to share with your indulgence. Can I just go a little bit back into the reasons for these amendments in the first place? Okay. In 1998, we put into place this EIA system, which was the first time in South Africa that there's been any systematic environmental management at all that was systematic. And what we did, the intention was to start with EIAs and to move beyond that. And what we then did was to go into a situation where to build the system, to establish the procedures, to get the trained people, to get an administrative system that could work efficiently, to address the multiple legal complexities that arose from different interpretations of the legislation, to deal with the issues of provincial capacity, to deal with the need for guidelines, particularly around what are the absolute bottom lines that have to be carried out, is what was done over a 10-year period. So after 10 years, we had a system that, in my assessment, was working imperfectly. It was working well where you had a provincial or national or our department that could do things well, and where you had trained and competent people, and where you had quite a lot of system and guideline development having happened, but it was very, very passionate about it. Secondly, the system worked on exemptions. If we were to go back and do an audit, you will really see that probably about 60 to 70% of every EIA application that came out of the 30,000 that were dealt with in the first 10 years of the system, probably 60 to 70% of them were exemption applications. And particularly as the pace of development in the country got faster, things like above ground storage tanks for construction activities, cell phone masks, changes of land use in already developed urban areas, the establishment of small manufacturing or small workshop type manufacturing or artisan type facilities in peri-urban areas all got dealt with exemptions. And in that process, one couldn't, in fact, and because you look at EIAs, one activity. You couldn't really take, and you authorized one activity, you couldn't take that broader view. We ended up with a tool that, as I've explained, was not appropriate to other kinds of activities. And we ended up with where there were problems in capacity with huge blockages in the system. And so what happened 2.5 years ago is basically my reading of what happened, is that everywhere you went, EIA was seen as the main reason for delays in development in the country. And as visa and the issues of job creation and growth and problems in doing anything were always seen as an EIA problem. And in my view, at that point in time, I think that there was a groundswell of opinion in the country that EIAs were an obstacle to development, and that obstacle had to be removed. In relation to that, we have already started the process of saying, let us look at over that what the experience is of that system, and let us make some suggestions about how we can make the system work better. And in July 2006 already, out of a process of about 2 or 3 years of work, together with the provinces and other national departments and extensive consultation with a set of stakeholders, we'd already come up with a set of regulations. The new set of regulations that were introduced in July last year, they tried to streamline and simplify the system. But those regulations were written in the framework of the existing law. And a whole lot of the things that we wanted to do that we thought could make for a better quality system, we couldn't do because we lacked the enabling clauses in the overarching legislation. So, using appropriate tools for appropriate activities, we couldn't do because we only had EIA. The issue of linking environmental planning and land use planning through the use of an EMS, so you're getting an alignment of your environmental management and your land use decision making, we couldn't do because it wasn't in the legislation. Secondly, there were other things that had come out of court cases and out of experience that we needed to have changes in the law made in order to be able to get the system to be a system, an environmental management system of excellence. And we can't go further in reforming the system and making it work better without these changes to the legislation. We went as far as we could in regulation. And now, unless we change NEMA, we're going to sit with a system that is exactly where it has been for the last 10 or 15 years. And as the pace of development grows, takes off in this country, our ability to do quality work, I think, is becoming impeded in a major way. I think the second issue is the issue then, and then the issue of mining CapEx. DEEP has never regulated mining. And it's kind of weird, it's a problem for the industry, it's a problem for stakeholders, it's a problem for us, and it's a problem increasingly for GME as well. Because of the anomalous situation that it finds itself in government, so then the mining issue came into this equation. And I mean, as Mr. Morgan has alluded to, there has been a political process around this. DEEP's view is that it is in the interest of the government and the economy and the country as a whole that all environmental management is dealt with in terms of one law. So that there is one bottom line for everything. And that we think that it will establish clarity and it will establish consistency and it will ensure that industry itself is not trying to respond to two systems from government, which is what is happening with the mining industry at the moment. It causes huge confusion and delays and time wastage and difficulties for everybody. So I think that's our principal position. How they think it's legislated, I think it's actually something that is outside the purview of our officials at this point in time, and I really think that it is. I mean, I think that we've gone as far as we can as the administrators to say what we think and what would work, and then it really is in your field to make the decision around that one. I think that on the question of how exemptions are dealt with currently, the way exemptions are dealt with are currently set up in the regulation. And what the regulations say is that people can't be exempted from the process. What people have to do, and at the moment in the way that the 2006 regulations are written, you essentially have two categories of activities. You have activities that fall into what we call basic assessment, and then we have a full approach. The basic assessment activities are the smaller activities which play a smaller part in the process. That have minimal impact on the environment. So the issue of extending a cell phone mast or the kinds of issues that I was talking about earlier. And there, it kind of what we've now done is to put in place a streamlined process around those smaller activities. But the way extensions work is that people need to advertise to the public, and it's set out in regulations the way you advertise. You have to put up a notice on the site where the development is going to happen. You have to advertise in newspapers, including in a local newspaper. You have to make sure that the adjacent neighbors and the interested and affected parties are informed of the proposed development. And then you have to give people 30 days to be able to respond and to put in place any objections. And you have to give the authority basic information to show why you think that this is something that is worthy of a streamlined process. On the basis of all of that, a decision is taken. And that decision can be appealed. in this amendment, you can still appeal. So the exemption is not a kind of do-nothing option. It is, I think, that there are a set of guidelines and regulations in place that say how and under what circumstances exemption can and can't take place. And if you do or don't issue an exemption, what must happen? And finally, what it does is to give people who are, don't agree with the decision to exempt, it gives them the right of appeal in the same way as you can appeal. And it's explicit in the law here that you can appeal an exemption decision. And then you've got a way an appeal has to be brought. So I think that the issue of exemption is actually quite tightly managed. And the one thing that you can't be exempted from is the public participation requirements. You can't get an exemption without informing the public of your intention to do it and giving them an opportunity to do it once.
I think what must also be understood is that you can only ask for exemption from certain procedural requirements. You cannot be exempted from the requirement to obtain an environmental authorization. So you must still obtain an environmental authorization at the end, and you must meet the minimum requirements to get that environmental authorization. You can be exempted from part of the procedures towards that environmental authorization. Nothing in the regulations can overrule the requirements that is in the Act. And the Act says you may not proceed with these activities without any money to authorization. So I think that is an important differentiation.
But is that clear enough in this
I think it is, and I think that if we move the clause, I want to now just talk about what the minimum requirements are in the bill as it is before you.
In section 24, no, it's here. It's on page 4 of the bill. If you look at line 5, 6, 7, the competent authority must ensure with respect to every application coordination and cooperation between organs of state in the consideration of an assessment for an activity falls under the jurisdiction of more than one organ of state. The competent authority must ensure that the findings and recommendations flowing from an investigation, the general objectives of integrated environmental management laid down in the Act and the principles set out in Section 2 are taken into account in any decision made in relation to any proposed policy program, process, and project. The competent authority must ensure that a description of the environment likely to be significantly affected by the proposed activity is contained in such application, and investigation of the potential consequences for or impact on the environment of the activity and assessment of the significance of those potential consequences of impact. And then we are suggesting the G3 and must ensure the public information and participation procedures which provide all interested and affected parties, including all organs of state and all spheres of government, that may have jurisdiction over any aspect of the activity, with a reasonable opportunity to participate in such information and participation procedures. So those are the actual bottom lines. For every application, those things would have to be done. We then say that there are certain other things that may be done. And then also suggesting that for each one of the tools that we're setting up, that you then would have guidelines. In relation to an FTA, I think the question is that Honourable Craven asked. At the moment, an FTA is a voluntary thing. And it has no legal force or effect. There has been a strategic environmental assessment done in the Wild Coast, but all it can do is act as a background document that then may or may not be taken into account in kind of the perspective of any particular authority that doesn't have force or effect. In our view, what similarly to an environmental management framework, an environmental management framework effectively does an environmental zone. It looks at the biophysical circumstances of a particular area, and it is in this area we think these kinds of activities can be allowed, or if you don't, these are what the thresholds are, and if you don't do them, if you allow them in areas where you shouldn't, these are the consequences.
And it then allows that tool to be incorporated into an IDP and to become something that, that helps to guide land use decision making and or to be incorporated into any other level of planning in government and to become a mandatory tool. On its own, it isn't at the moment. So we're doing some really excellent environmental planning work that at the moment has no legal force in effect and can be discarded by anybody because we can't have, do not have the legal basis in law to make it part of decision making. If we go ahead with these amendments, those things then become part of the decision making of all three spheres of government and have to be taken into account. Similarly, an SEA for the implement under household, we would be saying what is the nature of the receiving environment, not only now but into the future. What is the value of the resource that he sits there, that sits in that area in terms of the wetland system, in terms of the grassland in that area, in terms of the mining resource in that area? What would happen if you exploited one? What would the impact be on the others, not only now but into the future? And what does everybody do in that whole broad area say in relation to that? The outcomes of that SEA, in terms of the SEA guidelines, would then need to be taken into account in the individual decision making and for the individual activities in that area. You would still need to do EIAs, but the EIAs would then be informed by the outcome of that strategic environmental assessment. So you, if you said, for example, there's a threshold beyond which you start to basically kill off the system itself, and in your decision making you need to be able to identify where that is, and you need to, over a period of 10 or 20 years, or you needed to say that in order before, when you reach that point, you've got to let something else regenerate before another activity happens. That would then become a binding instruction that would need to be taken account of in the way that the individual EIAs or mining applications or whatever dealt with. At the moment, we can do as much strategic work as we want, but it's got no force or effect. So I think that what we're saying is if you want a comprehensive system of environmental management in this country, that to really take account of not only this thing happens on this piece of land, but what will it mean into the future? How does it relate to other decisions that are being taken? How does it relate to X, Y, and Z? We need a broader set of tools in the system, and we need those tools to have legal effect. If they don't have legal effect, you can do nothing. You sit with a whole lot of documents. And I think that is really where we as a department sit at the moment. We do lots of work. But until, I mean, it's all you know, with the EMS, what we've done is to do them together with the local authority and the provinces, in the hopes that the local authorities will then take that and incorporate it into the IDP so it becomes binding. Not binding on its own, it's only binding if the municipality voluntarily takes it and puts it into the IDP. And we think we don't want that level of voluntarism. If you've done an EMS, and there are EMS guidelines in the regulations that say, you've got to do it in a particular way, you've got to consult in a particular way, you've got to address particular issues, these are the bottom lines. We want to know if people have gone through that process adequately, that product is a product that has legal force and effect. And our view at least is that we try and manage development in this country by doing one-by-one assessments of one-by-one activities is not going to achieve environmental sustainability. And that we desperately, desperately need these tools. I think the second thing is that we dare not go back into the situation. I mean, at the moment we're keeping the system is running, we pretty much have cleared the backlog. By the end of March this year, the backlog in terms of the ECHA regulations would have gone. In terms of the July 2006 regulations, at the moment we're sort of keeping ourselves, we're pretty balanced. Things are fairly much on track with keeping. We put in place in the regulations mandatory time frame. So we have to process regulations within certain times. And we're keeping, we're just holding it. We're holding the ground on that and we're managing to do things within time. If growth in this country carries on at the pace that it is, we're going to lose it. With our current regulations and without a broader and wider set of tools and ability to have these other things that start getting embedded into planning decisions, we would end up in 2 or 3 years back where we were 3 or 4 years ago. And I think that is what we are trying to avoid. We're trying to look at how does the strategic tool then link to the individual EIAs and make that individual EIA create a much better, broader, more visionary, long-term framework within which the EIA's decisions get taken. I think really that is a tech relationship between EIA and the strategic tools and then more appropriate one-by-one tools for other types of activities that we think is going to mean that we actually have an environmental management system in the country that is capable of protecting the environment. And where the big long-term questions can get answered at an appropriate end. At the moment, we can't answer the question of what will happen to the environment in this country with every individual EIA we do. And it doesn't work. It really doesn't work very well because you need to have another place where a local government or a province or national government across the sector has a much more long-term vision and perspective and strategy that has been consulted and where there's broad consensus, and then you make your individual decisions with that as the reference point. And we lack the reference point in any binding way. So I'm sorry I took a bit long chair, but I think that really that is the kind of where we come from as a department and what our perspective is and why we think that these things are important. I think on the wrong
part. It was amplified. You see, the suggestion comes in within the very last part of what we see now. The best group, that is important intervention, is fishing. Also, the best in the past. But lo and behold, the Minister of Sport has said it in the spread of other. Same thing. Now, we must not just beat that. We must not rush to beat that. Pre-television, they are going to force us next day to try and come up and carry the money. Because it shows that the intent can come, then we must be too desperate in the time of good legislation, but cut the corners. So that's what I'm saying. Why don't we express together actually those elements that we know are definitely unresolved and are still a big problem? Put them aside, pack them up, and then turn the next 3 months. Everybody, even those people who come here, we all are feeling that not this much everything happens. So that's easy, because you're not doing anything. And you're also, save yourself from an attention of the environment. You can come in and do the things that you are so zealous about before Christmas. That must be in the field, but in the field. Precisely because you would then be maybe another law, you see, right in front of Parliament. So it's a very funny situation. You're over there. You give me a look from Parliament, maybe. Another law which contradicts what you see, and what intervention that happens in between, and there's no ultimate outcome. We're just hoping that there'll be confidence on this. What if there's no confidence from this side ourselves? Is one element. Now, let alone the other people that are there, that will be up in arms and this will be a wonderful invention.
I think I have two responses to the issue. I think our thing is that if we make the public participation mandatory and make clear that the exemption is exempted from procedures in regulation rather than from the law itself or the process itself, that we have gone a long way to address what is the underlying issues that were raised in the public participation. So we think that those things are quite easy to sort out and quite important. We think that the issue of tools should not be left for any length of time because I think that the longer we leave them, the more our one-by-one decisions do not enable us to get to grips with what the real environmental issues are in the country. I think that secondly, I have been to 4 or 5 or 6 meetings this year, where people stand up and they say we must get rid of these EIAs. And to be honest, I think that until we have a system that is works, I think that we're putting environmental management in this country at serious risk. And we as government cannot at this point in time go ahead and put in place that strategic approach to the system because we do not have the power to do it. So I think that we think that there are certain things that should and certainly could go ahead very, very quickly. I think that the concern that I'm hearing is a concern around the issue of money. And I don't know whether I can speak off the record in this forum or not, today, but I think that this is something that is being dealt with in the realm of politics and in the realm of the at a ministerial level, and it is a parliamentary prerogative. So maybe if I can say what my personal view is on a delay around mine. My understanding is that there has been interaction between the departments and the ministers, and that out of a difficult set of engagements over a very long period of time, there was an agreement that we needed to amend from our side, that what UME wanted was for their minister, or what their minister wanted was to be the competent authority for mining applications in relation to one system for the country. So my understanding is, and I think that the UME, I understand, was withdrawn from Parliament in order that they could amend it to get the alignment with NEMA, and that is, we have seen informally a version of a draft which hasn't come back into Parliament where they're trying to do that. So they are moving, it was taken out of their portfolio committee. They have done some redrafting to try and get that alignment. We have made comments on that, and that process will then move forward. And in return, or our part, what we needed to do in our legislation was to put that competent authority amendment in. If we take that out of the state, I don't know what the consequence will be. I think that that is something that really does need to be discussed within Parliament and with our principals, because it really is beyond my ability to comment on that. I think that for the sake of clarity or whatever, it might be. I mean, I can't say whether the portfolio committee should or shouldn't delay. I know that from the perspective of being with people who have to run the system and make it work, we are extremely worried that if we cannot get these innovations into the system in a binding way, we're going to lose key elements of the environment into the future. So I think that from our department we need it, and the regulations, the 2006 regulations, have got clauses in them, and we would like to be able to fix those. So, I mean, you know, as an administrator, I want the system fixed fast, to be honest. And I do understand, I think that the discussion about now or after Christmas or whatever is something that Parliament must consider itself. I think something that we are anxious about as administrators is that next year we do go into an election year. There are elections in 2009 and it's 2008 next year. So I think we have a real anxiety about getting, about the time frames, about getting it into, getting the process through Parliament. It still needs to go into the select and run a process through the select committee, and next year is going to be a very, very busy. We have a sense that next year, in the last year of a parliamentary and a political term, there's a lot of pressure on people to do a lot of things. So we were hoping, from an administrative perspective, that we could, in a sense, avoid the rush. But I mean, I think that really I'm not in a position to say to you, you must do it now or you must do it later. It is your decision and not ours.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Chair, the DDG seems to have read my mind, because I come from an area where a lot of mining is done, and this mining, what I would like to know is that will mining EIAD be done under NEMA? That's what I wanted to know. Because in the past, it has just been a random thing that the prospectors would come there, dig, leave holes, and when with those homes, well, when people don't come from area like that, they can say a lot of things.
But I've seen a lot of harm coming to people and animals because of those mines. And, here in our committee, I think we are here to protect the environment for even the generations that are coming, that is coming, not to neglect the other people. Because just now, Chairperson, well, under apartheid, it was said that mining brings in jobs. And but people died in the mines. People died in the gold mines, even those little diamond mines in the out in the areas where they live, the holes open and animals fell in there and people get hurt. And the people did get hurt there. And also, Chairperson, coal mining as well. Our people get sick. Even planting. Let's look at the Vaal. There's a place there in the Vaal where you cannot plant any, nothing grows. Nothing can grow there. The people try to make vegetable gardens. They can't. Nothing grows in that area. And which means, it shows that I don't know whether it's. That's why I want to know if mining is going to be done under NEMA. But although the DDG has alluded the BPE, but it really worries me because we are here to protect the environment in terms of our constitution, to protect our people. And when we know these things that happen, we know they happen in our areas. We know mining happens, you know, just anyhow. I would like a little bit of clarity on that, Chairperson. It is okay for people who don't know about this mining areas, especially when it is in rural areas, because they just go there and dig, make money. Sometimes don't even leave the communities around there. Even the owners of the place, whether they have title deed or not, even the owners of the place get no royalties out of it. And I think this thing about the mining has to be done. Otherwise, it has taken a long time and it has been neglected for centuries. Please check. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you to the DDG for giving us a very well articulated understanding of the underlying processes of their thinking. What I would just like to ask, I mean, you have stated very clearly that the backlog of EIAs is being cleared, but as development happens and it's regaining into an election year, that EIA system, as we know it and as it is now, has been found to be seriously flawed. So looking at a whole lot of other possibilities and strategic tools. Now, this is just a practical question. How do you anticipate that with a whole range of additional options that the capacity within the department is going to manage and cope with those when it couldn't cope with an EIA process that was quite well known and well established and where there was 10 years of experience. Maybe there's a whole lot that we don't know. But you did state as well that it would be really clear in the legislation itself that the EIA process would still have to happen, but with in a broader and more usable and accessible and useful way. Is that going to be in the, I mean, people don't want to have to scrub around looking for regulations that that clarify what is actually meant by 24N. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, I have a couple of points. I mean, one's related to what Honourable Khan has brought up. Is, I mean, I really agree with the philosophy of the strategic alignment with this. I think that this is the way that we need to be moving. My concern, however, is that, once again, I mean, do we have the capacity to do these strategic environmental assessments around the country and come up with a comprehensive plan given the kind of capacity problems we're facing with EIA? Secondly, with regards to that, is to what extent, I mean, I understand we're giving them more legislative authority now in terms of the way we make decisions. But I, you know, I have the honor of kind of sitting on this committee and Minerals and Energy Committee, and I see very contrasting approaches that get taken towards these issues. And I just wonder to what extent a CA is actually going to be taken into account and actually prevent a certain activity from taking place. I mean, you mentioned the Wild Coast strategic environmental assessment. I wonder to what extent that will hold any weight in terms of stopping mining in Coloberni. But, you know, that's something which we need to explore. But my second point, and more important point, is around this issue of, you know, these two legislations. I mean, I was sitting with the MPRDA in Minerals and Energy as well, and I saw the conflict going on there, and I saw the kind of backroom kind of talk happening and all of that. And I think what we need to prevent as a committee here as well is executive creep on these issues. I think that we need to step up to the plate on these issues and take responsibility, both as Portfolio Committee on Environmental Affairs and Tourism, as well as Environment, as well as Portfolio Committee on Minerals and Energy. We need to take responsibility for this legislation. Ultimately, we are the guys that are held responsible for the type of legislation that comes through. And I mean, I would suggest that we sit with Minerals and Energy. I think it is long overdue anyway, because the kind of discussions and hearings that I see happening in Environmental Affairs and Tourism, I get greatly encouraged by. And then I sit in Minerals and Energy and I see a completely different tack being taken. And I think that we need to find synergies between these two committees and in terms of the legislation that we produce. Because essentially what I'm hearing here is let's pass this legislation, essentially make the Minister of Minerals and Energy the competent authority, and trust that the MPRDA is going to come up with legislation that deals with NEMA and that puts those guidelines in place. I mean, I feel very uncomfortable about giving a blank check to Minerals and Energy and saying we trust that they were going to come up with something. I mean, there's various assurances being given, but I don't think unless we sit down as a joint committee hearing and actually come up with legislation and synergize with legislation, I'm not sure we're going to land up with the results that we want. And I would feel very uncomfortable with that. This is a big issue. It's mentioned in the piece. We have to streamline EIAs. We have to get this issue right. But let's get it right with Minerals and Energy as well. Let's all of us be happy at the end of the day. And let's deal with this in Parliament. I mean, I don't see why this has to be dealt with on another level. Let us take our responsibility in terms of legislation and get this right with both committees.
You're saying to us, the question that overall you're comfortable with the trust of the legislation. Your concern is that the cooperation or the reciprocation by CME only on the NPRC amendment.
Yeah. No, what I'm saying is that, I mean, yes, I like the fact in terms of peers and that being included and given authorized, given legislative authority to those tools, that's great. What I'm not comfortable with, though, is essentially what I'm hearing is that we need to make Minerals and Energy the competent authority when it comes to mining, and then we've got to trust that they are now going to be coming up with NEMA guidelines and obeying those within their legislation that they pass with the MPRDA. And I'm saying until we get those assurances by meeting together as a joint committee and looking at these various legislations and making sure we've got synergy, I would feel very uncomfortable about giving a blank check to them to say, well, we trust that that's going to happen because some political deal on an executive level has been made. I'm saying that we need to make that deal here as parliamentary committees and make sure that we've got that guidance.
Partly I'm covered, however, my question was going to be, if we go along with the suggestion that the competent authority is the Department of Minerals and Energy, now, what sort of systems or assurances can we have in place that would keep the Minister of Environment and Tourism informed as to what's happening within that other department is in line with the NEMA Act.
Thanks, Chair. My question is somewhat similar to the Honourable Mollet. I mean, currently in the under the MPRDA with its own system, it's not nearly as extensive in terms of the ability to for public participation. And one of the other things is even with regard to the issue of cooperative governance, I think it's section 40 of the MPRDA, there are components of their process where organs of state don't even have a role in commenting on various stages of mining. Now, those things, of course, would have to be substantially changed as well, and we have not got sight of that MPRD, that MPRDA piece of legislation. So I find that very, very problematic. The other issue, and this I think we should all discuss, is this issue of making the Minister of Environmental Affairs and Tourism the Centre for Appeal within the Department for authorizations granted by the Minister of Minerals and Energy. On the face of it, it looks like a good check and balance. But I just wonder in reality whether it can work when you have two ministers of equal standing in a cabinet where one has the ability to override the decision of another. I think it's problematic for issues of protocol and just for practicalities in terms of decision making. Decisions can be made, you know, at a cabinet level, and that is quite scary, I would think. With regards to the strategic tools, I mean, I'm very in support of all of these extra tools. I've been a long time advocate of the power of strategic environmental assessments, and we must support, and really I'm more than happy to provide my very active support to all of that. I agree with Yar with Shabab, the need to expand the environmental tools that we have, that while EIAs are very, very important, I'm not necessarily trying to, I don't want to diminish them, but the point is the larger plans that look at larger areas of land are really the most important tools with regard to the advancement of sustainable development. With that in mind then, I'd be very interested to get the DDG's comments on two things relating to that. And one is, I mean, are you confident that that these regulations will, say, in years to come, be able to contribute to a state of the environment report that is a bit more rosy? I understand in many places of the environment, not just development. And secondly, the National Strategy for Sustainable Development is still not enforced? I mean, are we, is this legislation before us the type of legislation in your mind that is going to allow us to be, as you said in reply to a parliamentary question which I've got in the last few days, instituted across all departments in South Africa? So I'd be interested in your comments on the relationship between the National Strategy for Sustainable Development and your proposed NEMA bill and its subsequent amendments to that bill before us. And lastly, then the issue of staff. I'm somewhat less worried about whether there's staff with SEAs, because presumably we can source those from the private sector. But I am interested in your own staff levels and the competent authorities. I won't worry about DME here. I spoke about that last week. But I understand that there's a need to streamline the actual processes. And the 2006 July regulations somewhat did that. But I'm also very concerned about the issue of your own staffing. So, for instance, in KwaZulu-Natal, where you currently have a 50% vacancy, that's 40 staff short, and in fact, I think in up to 7 provinces, there are major staffing shortages, which all affect staff, the turnaround time of authorization, and which subsequently, or presumably, is linked to why the department is now using consultants in order to process the backlog of applications under the previous EIA regulations. So, I mean, I understand there's 2 parts of this. One is that staff could be, there could be more, and they could be more competent and more skilled and turn these things around quicker when they can be turned around quicker. And the other side, have processes which are, at the same time, protecting the integrity of the environment, but not unnecessarily holding up development. But there is a staff component to this, and I would appreciate the comments by the DDG on that. And then I continue to hold the view, which has now been also articulated by Honourable Crayling, on the need to have a process with the Portfolio Committee on Minerals and Energy.
Just before we ask, I would like to get a clear sense of the content of the information. Because what I get is that overall, you're not sure. What is the key concern? What is it that you feel in the nature of the law? So that we can see how we can connect to that.
Well, the first issue remains the issue of the competent authority, and having said that, I understand that it's always been the case that they provided authorization to DME anyway. In the context of a bill which has many noble aims, I am suggesting that we have a unique opportunity with the MPRDA, potentially before Parliament again, to be able to engage as legislators with our fellow legislators in another committee, and not allow the executive to come to us with 2 pieces of legislation that are not standing next to each other, and where we don't have sight of each of them. So that's my concern with regard to that. The other issue, of course, just remains, for me, personally remains the exclusion, but when we go through it by clause by clause, I may seek further clarity from that. So the principal concern at the moment is the issue of the competent authority.
Now, on the exclusion, what are your concerns?
My concerns are the fact that I find it problematic. I understand that the DDG said that there are many, exemptions which are currently exist in up to 60% of time. But I just remain wary of giving the power of our portfolio committee over to the executive with regards to the issue of exclusion. So I can potentially, with more consultation, I want to go through, when we go through it clause by clause, I think that is the best time for it.
I don't think that it's just the concerns of the opposition. I think it's the concerns of a whole range of us. I think Mr. Zanga brought, Arnold and Zanga brought up those concerns with regards to mining as well. I think that I mean, what I see is that we are at a critical juncture in South Africa's history right now, where we are looking at expanding our energy generation. We are looking at massive expansion in terms of mining. We have seen the effects of past mining. We have seen, you know, I mean, DME always claims that they have the capacity and that to be able to regulate environmental issues regarding mining. And we've seen that in many areas they've failed in terms of that. And I think that what is important right now is that we get this legislation right so that we actually are fully in control and fully aware going forward in terms of an expansion of mining, what these costs are going to be, and we are aware of the alternatives. And all I'm saying is that I don't think that that conversation has really happened on a parliamentary level between this committee and Minerals and Energy. I see two very different focuses sitting on these different committees. And I think that we need to find synergy and perhaps looking at our legislation, two different types of legislation going through. We need to find synergies between that at a parliamentary level, and we need to find each other in terms of going forward into the future. And I think that that would certainly help in terms of a joint hearing. That's my feeling in terms of it.
Want to comment on that, madam?
Okay, Chair, would you like me to comment on all the issues that have been raised? Firstly, I think on your point about, I don't know whether you can put in a review into law, but I think the reality is that we see this as an ongoing process of development of a system. And certainly the way we work is that we will implement, we will monitor, we will evaluate, we will then say this works and this doesn't, and maybe some of it might require a further legislative changes, or maybe some of it are issues, problems that can be dealt with in at an administrative level. So I think that from our perspective is we see this as a process of growth and learning. And it's not, this is not for us casting some, it's an iterative process. You put in place something, you look at it, you review it, you say this is what is good, this is what is worse, this is what else needs to happen. So we see over years into the future that we're going to have a constantly growing environmental management system, both in terms of its scope as well as in terms of its quality. So review is something that we think is essential and good. On the issue of mining, I think the reality is, I think as Mr. Morgan said, DME are the competent authority for mining at the moment. They issue mining authorizations under the NPRDA. What we are suggesting is that they are the competent authority under NEMA. I think that as the point that was made is that under NEMA, I think that where the fundamental difference is going to be the level of essentially public involvement of public recourse, because I think that NEMA is much stronger on that. I think the procedures there are, I think that's the one side of what it would mean. The other side that it would mean is that you're going to get a significant streamlining in process for the mining industry itself, which I think is an important thing to say. One has to go be getting authorizations for the same thing or similar things from two different authorities. So, but I think the reality is DME is the competent authority for mining, and all the issues that you're raising around what you see as being problems or not problems is what is happening under that set of circumstances. I think there are reasons for efficiency and effectiveness in governance to get it into one system. I also think there's issues then of some of the issues that were raised in the public participation could maybe be dealt with a bit more effectively. Under the issue of capacity, I think that the reality is that the more the strategic tools are in place, the more you actually release capacity to be able to function more effectively. And the reason is that at the moment in the country, we've done about 27 EMFs that have already been done by these provinces and municipalities working together. And where those EMFs are in place, you then have, in a sense, an environmental master plan and guiding document that allows individual EIA decision-making to be made quickly, and you establish a very thorough information base that again allows you, when an individual EIA comes in, to be able to assess that much more quickly, because there's a very substantive information base about that area that has already been put together, and GIS systems and everything else. So our sense is tool help to streamline rely on the individual decisions and create a context that makes it much easier. You aren't answering at the moment with every individual application. You say, what does this mean now? What does this mean for the future? What does this mean for the area as a whole? With an EMS, those questions get answered up front, so you're then making a decision around an individual development. You're giving it a context. So I think that's the one thing. In terms of SEAs, we've got the Wild Coast SEA. We are embarking, we've tendered now, on the process of tendering out the terms of reference to an SEA for the Johurst Dam area, for the Sudan Steel Coast area. And the Mpumalanga Department of Agriculture is quite keen to do one for the Highveld. So, I mean, and those, I think, cover three major major pressure points in the country, and I think that we could, over time, we'll then obviously undergo others. And again, I think the other thing is that you are right, we have built a substantive EIA or environmental impact management and environmental planning capacity in the private sector in the country over the last 10 years. One of the things that we haven't really talked about is the fact that in this legislation we're also giving ourselves the power to establish registration authorities and quality control, what that industry does, but it is a growing industry, and in our view, there's quite substantial world-class capacity in that industry. I mean, if you look at it, we go along to the IA International, what's it called, the International Association of Impact Assessment Practitioners, and South Africa's work is, we can compete with anyone in the world in terms of the quality of the work that is produced. I think a lot of it is, I mean, there are a lot of shops out there who do really substantive work and rip off people, but I think the legislation is intended to establish the quality control system and we'll deal with that. But I think that that capacity, that strategic capacity for me is going to make the one-by-one system work much more smoothly. In terms of the questions around the National Strategy for Sustainable Development and the State of Environment reporting, I mean, yes, obviously all of these information bases are going to enable us to produce better products into the future and be able to measure things better. The National Strategy for Sustainable Development is in a final process of, I think it actually is already in the cabinet system. So, I mean, hopefully that will get finalized very soon. Our sense, though, I mean, maybe just to digress a bit, is that within government, and I think it's quite because I think of the international debate around climate change, but also because of the work that is being done around big infrastructure development, there's a growing understanding, certainly at the level of the administration, that there's a very big question for us as a country about how we manage our natural resources into the future. And whereas a couple of years ago, environment, I think, was seen as a joke in general by anybody who was doing development, we now have the economic department taking the issues that we are bringing to them with much, much greater seriousness. And I mean, one of the things that we would like to brief Parliament, brief the committee on next year, is we've done this piece of work on this long-term mitigation scenario planning for South Africa that looks at a very long time frame, looks since 50 years into the future, what is our country's greenhouse gas emissions going to be, and what does that mean for us? And really, within government, that piece of work and those issues have been taken with utmost seriousness. And as you know, kind of, I think at a cabinet level, there is a much greater sense of, there's huge interest and concern about those issues. So I think that the work that we do is being increasingly, I mean, I think that worldwide environment is becoming an absolutely pivotal issue for all countries, what is the environmental strategy. So I feel very optimistic about that. On the issue, I think the other thing about the strategic tools is over the last 4 or 5 years, we've done a lot of the work around developing the guidelines. These have produced about 26 guideline documents, including on SEAs and risk assessments and other aspects of the environment. And those are already used widely in the universities. All the universities that teach environmental management use our documents as the baseline text for training the students, and we're going to do more of that. To turn those guideline documents into a regulation or a guideline, put them out, a whole lot of them that were already in the process of development, put out for public comment, formalize that, I think is not going to be a big issue. So I think a whole lot of the building blocks are in place. The other issue on capacity is that they are, we have got given a large amount of money by Treasury 2 years ago for EIA work. We got given an additional 60 million over the MTS period, and we have asked in this MTS period for another 21 million, and I think the chances are probably reasonably good that we will get it. Of that, we are putting 20 million rand a year into the provinces. A lot of that money is on training. We're doing a piece of work with the Department of Public Service Administration to benchmark the job levels and the remuneration levels for environmental impact practitioners. We're about to do a big efficiency and effectiveness assessment of the system itself. And we're looking at a long-term EIN strategy. So I think that there's a whole lot of work happening around this law that are improvements to the system and to the quality of the work that we're doing. And in a sense, the way we understand it is this is what enables us for those things to all have the legal force and effect that is necessary to make a difference. I think on the issue, again, of what you do around the competent authority, I think it is not for me to comment on that. It is the portfolio committee's decision. For us, it's a good situation where DME is a competent authority in terms of another act, but they are a competent authority for mining. I think it is in the country's interest that we resolve this issue as soon as possible, whatever process you choose to do it through. I think that it is very important that a resolution happens sooner rather than later.
They don't align themselves with the process that we put also undertaking, whether it's to the level of the vegetable or whatever level. If they don't have to take, we still have got the right to draw whatever accommodation was given to them. So I'm not that much worried about that. I think it would be good to have a discussion at some point, but I don't think that should be one of the preconceived or for my head. I think the point that was raised that exclusion giving this power of exclusion to the power of the point and maybe could be just suggest that this exclusion must be speeded up to master. And they must come to us so that we can look at against other things, but the rules and so that we tighten them in the first place somewhat. Okay. I think the point that the DCG made earlier on that we should elevate the public participation with the mandatory element is of going to be. The last point would be on the guidelines to the content of the other tools. There are all the other tools, like environmental framework, environment assessment, blah, blah, blah. Again, I think that we should follow the minister to draft those, but again, those people can come to us so that we can see, you know, comfortable that the guidelines are to the standard. I think that for them to discover all the concerns that is being done. I want to comment on that. So if this helps us move forward, then we can do what we have to do.
Chair, on the issue of exemptions, what I was just suggesting is that we bring for the attention of the committee the regulations, a kind of maybe, and maybe we could do it after the lunch break, that we bring you the clauses in the existing and proposed regulations that deal with that, so that you can look at the way we were seeing that issue being regulated. It might be useful to just talk about what is currently and what is proposed in relation to the way things are being made. Which is what we used when we did the original briefing to you, which went through and explained what we wanted to do. Arising out of the public hearings, we have another two-page document that makes the suggestions around tightening up and addressing the issues that came out of the public hearing, which also needs to be circulated. I thought that copies have been made of that. That we have copies of, and then we'll be using our options.
Would you take a break for 10 minutes and then we can go to the court? This one is court particular, you don't have to court. Okay, we take a break for about 10 minutes or come back at 12.
Broadens it to include some of the strategic tools. Okay. Chair, if I may, I might, I think Ms. McCourt would also add at certain points to this. Okay. So adding the word processes in then adds, it's part of the thing of incorporating the strategic tools into the process. Okay. Then we've put in a new definition of commence, and this is because there has been confusion in around the country in how to interpret the existing definition of commence, and this expanded on what commence means in order that we give greater guidance in law on how in doing an EIA or in doing another process you understand it. And so what we said is that we're suggesting that we repeal the existing definition, and we're saying that we use in Chapter 5 means the start of any physical activity, including site preparation or any other activity on the site, in further of a listed or specified activity that does not include any activity for investigation or feasibility study purposes, as long as such investigation or feasibility study does not constitute a listed or specified activity. And essentially what that means is that commence means, it's site preparation. Specified refers to the areas in the in the legislation that deal with the issue of sensitive areas, where you specify that an area is a sensitive area, or you specify that an area is not a sensitive area. So that's why we've added that word in and provides the linker. And then what we say that it does not include any activity required for investigation or feasibility studies, because you have certain things, and particularly I think in relation to mining or geological thing, you can go onto a site with an instrument that measures the level of radiation in the soil, And in that sense, you start the process, but that process does not actually physically alter the nature of that stuff. And so you don't want to make people go through an EIA process for commence at that level, but you want to be much more clear about what commence means. So that was intended to clarify that definition. Okay, so that's the issue of drilling holes, the issue of drilling holes as opposed to tile burning as an incinerator where you're going to send emissions up into the air. And that's what the example is. Okay, we then get on to the definition of competent authority. And there I don't think I need to explain it, that's what we've been talking about a lot today. We've included the Minister of Mineral and Energy Affairs as a competent authority. Clearly there's a view that must be taken on that. The next definition of development footprint we've put in, and it's basically, we put in, there are other insertions that then require a definition, but it's also a clarificatory one, whose development footprint means the land physically transformed as a result of the undertaking of the activity. And that's when people apply for an EIA, and that they were going to build a shopping centre, and on a 50 hectare site, you're going to do a 3-hectare development. You need to be able to say what is the development. You need to then be able to identify what the development footprint is as opposed to what is the overall site. So it's also something that gives greater clarity and it's been a source of confusion in the past. Okay, the next definition is the definition of environmental authorization, and we've amended it. To say that environmental authorization used in Chapter 5 means the authorization by competent authority of a listed or specified activity in terms of this Act and includes similar authorizations contemplated in the specific Environmental Management Act. Now, a specific Environmental Management Act are the other NEMA Acts. So it is the Air Quality Act, the Biodiversity Act, the Protected Areas Act, well, there's the Integrated Coastal Management, but it's a waste book. And as we have explained to the committee when we did the original briefing, what we're trying to do is to ensure that all authorizations that are under the control of one director general and one minister can be issued through one process and one information base, and this definition then allows, that amended definition then allows that to happen. So we've expanded the definition of environmental authorization in order that that streamlining of permitting can happen. And the example that we've given here is a waste management permit. So instead of, if you apply to DEEP for a waste management, you want to set up a landfill site, you've got to apply to DEEP for two things. At the moment, you apply for a license for the landfill site, you apply for an EIA to set up the landfill site. And at the moment, those processes don't speak to each other at all, but it's exactly the same thing. So we've tried to use good news together. What we've done, I'll come on to that, it's not dealt with in the definition section, but it's dealt with in another amendment in 34A, where we deal with that. So then we go through this, I'll explain that later with that part of the subject. In 34L, it is in 24L. It didn't require a change to the definitions. At the moment, these are the only things that require definitional changes. So I'll explain it later. And the example that we've given here is of aquaculture, where abalone is formed in the sea outside of the area of natural distribution. You need permits in terms of the Biodiversity Act. You may need permits in terms of the Integrated Coastal Management Act, and you need an EIA. And this change in definition allows one process to be followed instead of three. In terms of norms and standards, we've inserted a definition of norms and standards. I think that when Busa gave their presentation to public participation at the public hearing, they were doing schema norms and standards, but it's just we put in a definition. It means any norm or standard that's contemplated in terms of section 2410. And when we come on to 2410, we'll go into it in detail. Then we've put in a new definition of spatial development tool, saying it means a spatial description of environmental attributes, developmental activities, and developmental patterns and their relationships to each other. And that is because one, in terms of the new tools, needs to deal with spatial development frameworks, bioregional plans, management plans for protected areas, coastal zone management plans, etc. So essentially it allows us to give meaning to the use of a spatial plan in the rest of the world. Then the next, we've inserted a new subclause 5 in section 1 that clarifies that when the principal act does not make provision for a procedure, when an administrative process must be carried out or a decision needs to be taken, then the promotion of administrative justice act applies. So all it does is the catch-all, it's the default. If you don't set out the procedure, then PAJA applies. And so the definition says any administrative process conducted or decision taken in terms of this act must be conducted or taken in accordance with the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act of 2000 unless otherwise provided for this act. And what it would mean is that aggrieved parties would need to follow the PAJA process. So they would need to basically go through the process of exhausting the administrative process before they would go to court to try and get a decision overturned. Okay, the next one is environmental authorization, and this is very long, huh? I'm just looking, sorry, Chair, I'm just looking at how long it is on my screen. It's the amendment of section, the whole of section 24. Okay, and I'm going to ask Ms. McCourt at the point that we need to refer to the two-page document to just the loose. Sorry. I never realized what you're talking about. So what the proposed amendment is in clause 24.1. We said in order to give effect to the general objectives of integrated environmental management laid down in the chapter, the potential, and we've taken out just impact and said consequences for all impacts on the environment of listed or specified activities must be considered, investigated, assessed, and reported to the competent authority. And the why authority is really shouldn't be. Okay. And there, when we said impact, consequences for all impacts, again, it's because you're using a set of broader tools that are not only looking at the direct impact, but in the case of the strategic environmental assessment, are looking at much more at consequences as well. So it allows for that longer time frame, broader perspective in the way that we're doing. Then there's just a clarity in 24.2. We see the minister in Tibetan and every MEC sees the minister or an MEC with the concurrence of the minister. Then it may identify activities which may not commence without environmental authorization, which is exactly, there's no change in 24A. In 24.2A. In 24.2B, it says geographical areas based on environmental attributes and as specified in special development tools adopted to prescribe and by the environmental authority, which allows for the use of BMFs and other tools, and which specified activities may not commence without environmental authorization to the competent authority. And so essentially what we're saying is that the Minister of the MEC can say, I mean, and maybe the example is an example of an area in the World Heritage Site. It's a highly sensitive area, and you're saying that the MEC or a minister may say in this entire area, due to sensitivity, you have to have authorization no matter how big or how small the activity. An example that I would use is say in the Cradle of Humankind World Heritage Site, you may not want to allow anybody, you don't want to allow people to put up a cell phone bonus mask on a hill where you might have a kind of an irreplaceable fossil in the ground. So even though that cell phone mask in another context is an entirely irrelevant thing, in that context, it becomes very important that you actually go through a full environmental authorization. So it allows you to identify those areas up front. And essentially, I think we're talking about our irreplaceable natural areas where you want to make sure that you do a very, very thorough job and nothing is automatically or upfront excluded. Yeah.
I'm just asking that point. In which specified activities may not connect. What do you mean by specified? Because what I'm hearing you say is all activities.
Okay, these are the ones. This is the enabling clause for two social and environmental management framework, where you would map the area and you would say this is appropriate development for zone A, and then you would say in zone A of this area, these activities may occur without an environmental authorization. In zone B, let's use the World Heritage Site as an example. We could say that we are not opposed to things like guest houses or tourism type of activities in certain zones, and therefore they will not be listed. But if they are in other areas, so if they are not already listed in the overall list of things that require EIA, an additional thing might be listed because the area is sensitive. So we might, for example, say now 15 beds of a resort require an EIA regardless of where you are, but we can now say in a sensitive area, even if it is 3 beds, you require an environmental impact assessment. So there would need to be a list of activities for that specific identified area. And the process for that is described in the regulations in terms of how you do this. How do you map the area? How do you identify the activities? What public participation do you go through to get that regulated and then you require an environmental impact assessment process for them? Of that area. What you'd have is you'd have an environmental framework or an environmental management plan for the whole of the Freda Fort Dome area that goes across the two provinces. In 24C, of which we're going to come on to, we identify, we set out exactly how we decide who should be dealing with that authorization, and whoever deals with it would then be able to use the plan that has been prepared in order to be able to determine how or when or where that those developments get regulated. Okay. Then C, it talks about geographical areas based on environmental attributes and specified in spatial development tools adopted to describe manners in which specified activities may be excluded from authorization by the competent authority. So basically it is the reverse of the one above, and the example I think would be if we took Manrisa's example of the Sattelberg Vereinigung area, you would say on the one hand your environmental management framework would say here's an area where you may not have any agricultural activity because you know the land is contaminated. So you might exclude that, but you might also say on that land we will allow a kind of industrial development or factories to be set up or particular kinds of activities because those clearly can, you're not going to harm the environment or people further in relation to that particular kind of land. So it allows you to then exclude, so you might say any factory that does X, Y or Z may be allowed in that environmental area and you would then exclude it from the process. So it allows, the one says when you're going to say it may not happen at all without authorization, and the other one says that there may be. And I think the classic one there, again, is now I've used cell phone masks a lot, it would be to say that in an industrial area, the expansion of a cell phone mast from 12 to 25 meters is going to be excluded from authorization. In an industrial area, it doesn't have any kind of impact on the environment, and then you would be able to exclude it in terms of whatever that plan is for the area of the zoning that has been set out in that plan.
Just on that point, I mean, this is a concern of mine. I mean, I understand the example given in terms of Sattelberg in the area might be contaminated in the soil and that. What I don't want to happen is, for instance, a place like Kuka, where it's not industrial at this stage, but then it gets designated as an industrial zone. The ground might not be contaminated now, but because it's seen as an industrial zone, we will therefore give exemptions to certain things to encourage this kind of industrialization. Now, without looking at the particular environmental constraints around that, can you lay my concerns in terms of that situation?
I think you must certainly remember that the exclusions is based on a special development tool that has been adopted and extended after the process has been followed. So it's not just an exclusion because it is Kuka. There has to be a plan like the environmental management framework that would say this is the state of the environment, this is the desired state of the environment, this is the type of emissions that we can allow or not allow to maintain the state of the environment that we want, and certain activities with certain emissions will never be excluded. So specific activities. We would, for example, say the storage, these above ground storage tanks for construction purposes could be excluded in Kuka provided that you do X, Y, and Z. But aluminium smelter will never be excluded because the activity in its own right is of such a nature in terms of its environmental impact that a special tool cannot prevent that activity or cannot predict and manage the impact of that activity. So it's through a process looking carefully at what is there, what can be allowed there, what are the norms and standards in terms of which it can be allowed, and then say, that's why we're not saying all activities, we're saying specified activities. So we would say, in order to put a power line through Kuka, provided that you are in the zone set aside for power lines, you do not have to do another environmental impact assessment process for it because you've done an environmental impact assessment process for the entire Kuka development. So we're not repeating the process unnecessarily. But if you put a smelter on, we have areas identified for industrial development, but the smelter has unique environmental impact that you cannot on a strategic and social level address.
Any
And I think that the issue is that the development of that plan has its own process of consultation. Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's probably against my point. I mean, to me, this needs to be the interface. When you do an environmental management framework plan for Kuka, and you'll look at the environment around it, you'll come up with certain conclusions about what type of development should be. But it's clear that there's other prerogatives been pushed there where they see this as an industrial zone. Now, where's the interface between those two things? And if the conflict between that, how do we manage that? I mean, this is related to my earlier question. You know, what authority will the CIA have, will the EMM have, in governing the kind of industrial push of the third management?
I mean, I think that the one that we can use as an example is an environmental management framework that was currently in regulation. What an environmental management framework does is to say that if you do some things, and not everything, certain things, certain specified activities. As I said, some activities in their own nature, we would never exclude. You just want to take the EMF into consideration in your decision making. But we could say, if you want to do a cell phone mask in zone A, B, and C, you are excluded from doing an environmental impact assessment. If you are doing it in G, you require an environmental impact assessment, and you need to say how, if zone G is not suitable for this type of activity, according to the EMF, that's been through a public participation process, that's been officially accepted and adopted after it's been through a scientific process of development, why do you want to do this activity that is not conducive in that specific environment? So the interface is twofold. The first thing is the strategic process goes through a scientific and the public consultation process, which is then an approved document that has the legal standing, which either means you have to do development in line with it. If it's not in line with it, you need separate authorization for every single thing that is not in line with it after you've done an individual EIA for those activities.
The issue then is that any environmental decisions in that area would need to take that document into account. You couldn't take a decision that was inconsistent with that document. The second thing is that there's then a process in the way that you do it to try and get those conclusions and that document formally accepted by either a provincial executive or a municipality or incorporated into the IEP so that in terms of the overall, that broader kind of spatial planning framework that is then become binding in a number of the EMFs that are included into IDPs already. So, I mean, a lot of that then starts with the process and getting the buy-in up front from all of those different parties that they're part of the process, that they want to, the conclusions, and that they want to use it for that, for their own broader planning as well as the environmental planning. But at this point in time, once you have that tool, and once that tool has gone through the process of public participation and has been formally accepted and endorsed, then it must guide how the environmental decisions are taken. We take the point and we'll use other examples. But I think the reality is that they stop and mark for illicit activity because they do have impact on the environment. There are lots of them. So they clog the system in a major way, and in certain areas people get very upset about it. Some of the biggest public participation happen when you put the cell phone mask in a school or next to someone's house. Then you end up, so in fact, it's a small example, but it is really an example of how the system can get clogged up as well. Okay? But we take the point with these other examples. The next amendment.
The person with terminologic activity might then say that, how do you know it will have a testimony? You know, I'm just wondering whether it should really will. Because the person might say that it's not having a testimony.
Thank you, Honorable Kachalia. That one in red has actually been deleted. So we've taken that whole thing out and it's been replaced by the green one, which says activities contemplated in paragraph A that may commence without environmental authorization, but that must comply with prescribed norms or standards. And I think, Honorable McQuena, that is where the solution to your cell phone mask issue comes in. Because what we don't have at the moment is something that sets a norm or a standard for the construction of cell phone masks, and therefore when you build those cell phone masks, you
need to go through the same process for every cell phone mask as you do at the moment for a jack. So I think the norms and standards, the construction around norms and standards allows you to use it as a standard in order to deal with
those small issues that at the moment clock the process. So that really is allowing for norms and standards. Then I just want to go through, there's some small changes in the next one. There's been some grammatical and language changes around the way we refer to a MEC instead of every MEC or such MEC. So I'm not going to go through that because it's just a tidying up of language from the original, from the Act. It doesn't affect any, it's got no substance implication at all. Then under number four is again going back to, remember we put in that definition of consequences, the added consequences or impacts. Is this is in number four, says procedures for the investigation, assessment, and communication of the potential consequences or impacts of activities on the environment. And again, that allows us to bring in the issue of the strategic tools. We then get on to 24.4a, which says this is the must section, and it says you must ensure with respect to every application for an environmental authorization, and these are the new bottom line, and you will remember that we are suggesting that 24.4b becomes number 4.3 becomes 4B3, it moves up here. Okay, I'm actually working from the wrong document. So what we're doing, we're saying what must be done is to firstly, activities contemplated in paragraph A that may commence with, It says the minister and an MEC. Okay, sorry, 24.4. It says procedures for the investigation, assessment, and communication of the potential consequences or impacts of activities on the environment must ensure with respect to every application for an environmental authorization, and then 24.1 gets inserted. Coordination and cooperation between organs of state and the consideration of assessment where an activity falls under the jurisdiction of more than one organ of state. So that, for example, is where you have a land use, change of land use, and a license issued by a national department, and an EIA done by ourselves. So it says coordination and cooperation. Secondly, under number two, that the findings and recommendations flowing from such investigations the general objectives of environmental management laid down in this Act and the principles of environmental management set out in Section 2 are taken into account in any decision made by an organ of state in relation to any proposed policy, program, plan, or project. Essentially, what it means is that NEMA principles have got to be taken into account in any decision making in relation to any application or any decision maker taken. So that kind of binds the decision making process to the NEMA principle, which we think is a really important thing you've got to have. Then the next one is 3, that a description of the environment likely to be significantly affected by the proposed activity is contained in such application, and that's bottom line, that you can't make any decision without a proper description of the activity. Then in 4, we've got investigation of the potential consequences or impacts of the activity on the environment, and assessment of the significance of those potential consequences or impacts must be addressed. So you've got to say, here's what the activity is, and this is what the activity could do. And then you've got to then be able to have those two pieces of information in order to be able to make a recommendation, so that is mandatory. And then what we're suggesting is that 24B3, which is line 39 on page 4 of the amendment bill, which says public information and participation procedures, which provide all interested and affected parties, including all organs of state and all spheres of government that may have jurisdiction over any aspect of an activity, with a reasonable opportunity to participate in such information and participation procedures, and we're suggesting that that goes in order to address the concerns about public participation not being mandatory. So we're suggesting that that clause goes up and becomes gets inserted there into the must section in under 244A. It is B3. On page 4, it's line 39, B3, on page 4, what we're suggesting is that clause gets moved up from B into A, so that it becomes a mandatory requirement of the process. And we, for all processes, yeah, it doesn't matter what it is, we're saying there has to be consultation with the public, whatever it is.
So this D3,
we move it to? B3, it's D3, but we move it up into A. It'll become A5. Yeah. And then we go on to, yes, and then for 4B. Okay, and with 4B, instead of, this is the two-page document that you've got, and we're suggesting on page 4, from line 29, instead of 4B, starting with may include, we say must include, with respect to every application for an environmental authorization and where applicable, you then go on to 24B1, investigation of the potential consequences or impact of alternatives to the activity on the environment and assessment of the significance of those potential consequences or impacts, including the option of not implementing the activity. Okay, and can Lisa explain?
Must, where applicable, then put the emphasis on having to consider the applicability of it instead of saying may, which is totally discretionary. So we would need to then say why is alternatives, for example, not applicable to risk assessment or to cost-benefit analysis. Because you have to say the applicability, so you still have an element of must, and there needs to be a consultation on why it is not applicable to what is left out, why the may is totally discretionary.
So I think that
in amending this one, this clause in this way, a further amendment is in order to, we've taken into account the sentiments at the public hearing, which concern was expressed that we had made the consideration of alternatives discretionary. And here what he's saying is you have to consider whether the tool is appropriate and whether you must consider alternatives or not. And you've got to then give a reason for your decision is the consequential implication of that. So if you say that you don't need to consider alternatives, you have to be able to justify why you don't consider alternatives. In the draft that the previous, in the version prior to the public hearing, we had it as a completely discretionary thing. You didn't need to do it at all.
I don't know if this is the right time to bring it up, but I mean, obviously, other states were specifically expressed that around that clause must ensure we're applicable. But, I mean, are we going to revisit the language of all of this and look at possible, are we just going through this at the moment? Because we need to look at possible suggestions as to how that language could be changed, if that is the case.
If you want to tighten the material,
you
can
It's not really a tightening though, it's just a major kind of, I mean, you've got to think about that quite long and hard about how we put that into language that captures what we are trying to achieve. I don't have a solution for it now, but I mean, I think that we need to revisit that particular one.
Thank you, Chair. With regard to the point on the BI, I suspect you may do it DDG, but could you give us specific examples in terms of your thinking on the regulation on each of these Roman numerals that flow out of it? That is the must where applicable, and why you see them being included in that list and not the first list. And I mean, I have a particular problem with four, reporting and gaps in knowledge, the adequacy of predictive methods, underlying assumptions, because that seems to go to the very heart of the precautionary principle, which is important in NEMA, and wondering specifically why that could not be, in your view, under the A section.
Okay, so then if we go on to one, we say investigation of the potential consequences or impact of alternatives to the activity on the environment and assessment of the significance of those potential consequences or impacts, including the option of not implementing the activity. So for example, when you're doing a plan rather than an individual EIA, so what you're considering is this plan an acceptable plan? Clearly you're not going to have to consider an alternative to the plan. In the plan itself, you consider this activity rather than that activity in this area rather than that activity, but it doesn't apply directly to the issue of a particular strategic tool. Similarly, a risk assessment. What you're saying is, what is the risk of doing this particular activity, rather than saying, what are the alternatives to the activity itself? What you're trying to do is to assess the risk of something happening, and rather than saying, should we do it, should we not do it? If in the risk assessment you then discover that there is a huge risk, you might then come back and say, okay, well, is there an option not to go ahead? That's where the way applicable would come in, but it's not inherent to the process. With EIA, you inevitably do want to, not always, in most cases, look at what the alternative is. And the example that I used earlier of clearly where you wouldn't in an EIA is with a storage tank for a construction activity.
you know, there's no other alternative location or alternatives. The only way you can get the diesel to the construction site is by having a tank. So there you're going to rather look, use a normal standard to say the tank must be managed and constructed and built within a particular kind of way rather than is there an alternative to the tank. So, I mean, I think that there is that test, and in regulation you set out exactly under what circumstances you use which and where alternatives must be considered and on what basis. Then number C is investigation of mitigation measures to keep adverse consequences or impacts to a minimum, and again with a strategic tool. Well, the strategic tool, you might consider it in a generic sense, but you wouldn't consider it in relation to individual activity. Then we've moved D3, we've suggested that that goes up into A, so I'm not going to deal with it there. We think that that must now be, we're suggesting to the committee that you consider making it a mandatory clause in as part of the absolute essential bottom line. E, reporting on gaps in knowledge, the adequacy on predictive methods and underlying assumptions and uncertainties encountered in compiling the required information that may or may not be necessary to assisting on the tool. For an environmental management framework, that wouldn't be necessary, but for an individual EIA, it would be. You would need to explain what your assumptions were in collecting that information. Then, under 5, the investigation and formulation of arrangements for the monitoring and management of consequences or impacts on the environment, and the assessment of the effectiveness of such arrangements after the implementation. Again, that is something that you would need for every single one of the tools that we are looking at. For a life cycle assessment, you would be looking at something different. You'd be saying, here's a particular product over the time of its life, what impact does it have on the environment? But you wouldn't actually necessarily monitor in a life cycle assessment. You don't get inherently you don't monitor on an ongoing basis. You're doing a different piece of work. Where you're looking more at the implications of an activity, but you're not necessarily looking at the action that flows from it. So it links to the different tools. We thought we were going on until 4 this afternoon, Jeff.
No.
Chair, might I then ask, because I tomorrow we're supposed to do both the waste bill briefing and we're supposed to carry on with this. I'm just wondering in terms of timing, whether can I maybe have a separate discussion with you on timing, because I need to know what people are set here tomorrow. Okay, thank you.
This is London V8.